Here's the thing. If you can't spot the sucker in your first half hour at the table, then you are the sucker.
Woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
Trip. On a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 5, NASDAQ Futures up 121. Yes, let's keep this going. Let's go to the moon here. We're going to do this. We have the Fed speak yesterday. We have a CPI number that came in very tepid, especially after adjustment. The number was 0.2, and they adjusted it to 0. So there's no inflation. Everybody's happy. Do we have Lou? Is he happy?
Not happy at this hour of the morning.
I might
be calm, but I'm not happy.
Well, I mean, as Walter Brennan said, you get up, check the paper for your name and the old bits, and if you don't see it, you go to work. So you already checked your name, and here you are.
Yeah, that's right. I've got somebody calling my name.
There you go.
I guess I'll take it.
So what's up? Anything good?
We set our record high temperature here in Denver yesterday at 97 degrees, and
wow.
it felt like it. I unfortunately was at a funeral for a friend, and standing outside at the gravesite in a black suit is a hot way to go on a day like that.
In a black suit, were you the undertaker or were you a visitor?
No, I was just one of the speakers at the memorial service.
This is the gentleman who was a listener to the show.
Yes, that I mentioned earlier. Yep, Dan Jarka.
Well, so, R.I.P. Dan, good guy, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to see how, and social media has. This is one good thing about social media. My classmates were coming out of the woodwork yesterday on Facebook, along with a bunch of other people that had flown with him and worked with him over the years. With tributes, and it's nice, but it's kind of moving to watch, you know, all of this surge kind of take place. If you doubted, you know, the reach of your career or your influence, something like this, where it wasn't thousands of people, but. You know, a lot of folks put stuff up on Facebook from both my class, who he was well known in my academy class, and his time as a B-52 navigator, because he was a bomb nav guy, so he actually ran the bombing aspect of the aircraft, but he was also an instructor, and so he taught hundreds of younger officers as they came up through what's called the Combat Crew Training School at a place called Castle Air Force Base. All B-52 crews go through that spot, and Dan was a well-known, well-liked, well-respected instructor there. Somebody who, like I said, you don't It's too bad maybe he was aware of this while he was alive, but you know, it sometimes it takes somebody's passing to sort of get the scope of the impact that they had on people across their lives. Dan, you know, you could clearly see that impact in the expressions of regret and memory that came out yesterday.
Well, Lou, there's a school of thought that says you're sort of here on Earth to help other people get through it. And people who are givers, if they last 60, 70, 80, 90 years, they forget all the people they help along the way. It's just a habit. They just do it. The other people don't forget. They remember that somebody helped them and other people didn't.
Yeah, Dan obviously was not somebody who was keeping score. And I at his memorial service, I noted that, you know, the thing that when I was thought of him, I always thought of him as authentic. He was one of those guys that didn't really carry much of a veneer that the rest of us wear to protect people from seeing, you know, what we're thinking or what our motivations are. When he spoke to you, it was from the heart and it was direct. And I noted that people like that are they're incredibly problematic for large bureaucratic organizations, which made it ironic that he was in the Air Force. But at the same time, they have a tremendous impact within those, you know, within the subunits of those large bureaucracies. And that was Dan. He did have a reputation at and this, by the way, this will fit, I'm sure, your sort of your characterization of somebody who's authentic. He had a reputation as a, you know, kind of a grumpy, you know, big bear of a guy. He was a rugby player at the academy. And
how the hell do they have a rugby team if you're not supposed to get a concussion?
The same way that boxing was a mandatory subject in physical education there. And I knocked out two guys that I boxed against when I fought. I hear you. But anyway, he played rugby there, and he had a reputation at the training school of being one of those guys that, you know, the pilots and co-pilots were kind of afraid of him, and so were all the NAV students because he would just tell you what he was thinking, and would give you a straight assessment. And I noted again that, you know, authentic people can be incredibly valuable. It's, you know, a blessing. They can also be a curse, but in the form of the blessing, you always know where you stand. And if to get, you know, to get honest feedback, to have somebody who would sit down and tell you, yeah, this is where you screwed up or this is where you did really well, and to know that that was an accurate perception and not just somebody blowing smoke at you, then that's a pretty special thing.
Well, I know you, well, I suspect that back in the day you read the Winds of War.
Mm-hmm.
And Herman Wolk spent a real lot of time giving you the background of the you know, the protagonist in the thing. How's that for a word this hour of the morning?
It's a lot of syllables for this hour.
Pug Henry, and he was talking
about
he was, when he was in the at West Point, he was a fullback and he was a champion boxer, and he was about as straight as they come, to the point where I said one of his things that he would do is when he came home after a few drinks, instead of just crashing, he would write a letter to somebody about his observation of the day, if it was against, you know, even if it was color of the battleship or something, if he saw one coming, because evidently at one point the British decided to paint theirs all in like a camouflage. By the way, do you paint in camouflage? You must, I guess. And how he spotted them a lot quicker than he did the U.S. ships that were just plain battleship gray. And anyway, he would write these kind of things to people, you know, whether the torpedoes were good enough, whether the, you know, whether the, with the new torpedoes, were the armor belt on a ship good enough. And most of the time it was against policy. But because everybody knew he was so straight and you could always count on him, they put up with it, even though they hated getting these observations. But if you didn't have that background and you didn't realize he was a straight dude, you would never put up with it.
Well, and again, the key here, and this echoes throughout Wauk's stuff. I mean, the Kane Mutiny is this kind of a study as well. The key here is that somebody high up recognized this guy for what he was and how valuable this input was. Because, as you well know, people who say what's on their minds or express their thoughts directly, especially in a situation where they're pointing out a weakness or a problem with the organization's goals or structure, are frequently perceived as being disloyal. And weak leaders, insecure leaders, we have a few.
We got a bunch.
Can't handle that. They're not able to look past the disloyalty. They're threatened by somebody like that, and they're not able to look past the disloyalty to the merits of whatever the individual said. This has been an ongoing theme, something that I've looked at in my life, because ever since I became aware when I was I was a cadet about Hyman Rickover and what, you know, what happened, how he, or not Hyman, well, Hyman Rickover was one, but Zumwalt, who was, you know, the Air Force has not developed, and I don't think likely now will develop for a while, the kind of individualized leadership that you see developed in the Army and the Navy and the Marine Corps. And that's an institutional issue, and I don't think the service will ever come to grips with it.
Why did that happen? Because the first guy who was one of the best, was it Hep Arnold?
Arnold and Spots. But Arnold was an Army officer, of course, so was Spots. And those guys, you know, those guys came up through a different kind of bureaucratic setting. The Air Force, and I, you know, I'm going to get myself in trouble with any of our people who served in the Air Force, but I consider the Air Force to be the least intellectual of the major services. It is run and managed, and historically has been run and managed by technicians. And technicians are not guys who tend to sit back and think, they think about technology and they think about the implementation of technology, and we're really good at it. But you're not going to get the kind of, you know, strategic deep thinking that is recognized and promoted in that service. You tend to end up with leaders who are
Why does West Point pop these quote leaders out and the Air Force Academy not? Or is it VMI or these other places?
The academies. The Air Force doesn't really know why it has a service academy. It hasn't come to grips with that yet. And now this, Tom, this is all my personal opinion now. We're way into the weeds of Lou's view of the world. But the Air Force Academy does produce people like this. I served with a number of them. And there are other people like this in the Air Force. But they don't get promoted. You know, they're not recognized. That skill set is not recognized. We're starting to get away from it. The thing that got recognized was being a fighter pilot, being a great stick, being a guy who understood the airplanes and could support the technology. I'll tell you something terrifying. The Air Force, to a greater extent than the other services, was for many years, and I assume still is, hand-picking and selecting its superstars when they were captains. And it was a terrible bureaucratic mistake. But they would identify guys as captains who were, you know, the smart ones, the thoughtful ones, or the guys that were gonna go with the program. And once these people got identified, they started on this sort of golden career path. And the circumstances were such that you could make some very serious mistakes if you'd been identified as one of these junior superstars, and your career was not going to get derailed.
Well, was that anything similar to what Mike was telling us about Mike Murphy about the Army? He said when he was he was a major, I think. And when he didn't make colonel, they booted him.
Well, that's normal. That's up or out.
Okay.
And yeah. You so if you get to the goal is to get to field grade. It's major and above. And once you get that, you can get to 20 years. If you don't get promoted past major at your 20-year point, you're separated. And you know, I got to lieutenant colonel. I was allowed to stay in. I think the lieutenant colonel top out at 27 years. Colonel's a little bit further, and then the stars can go into their 30s as service careers. But you know, the idea that you would be able to identify, you know, some 25 or 28-year-old as a budding superstar is simply nuts. A lot of guys come out of the woodwork when they get to field grade. A lot of the leadership traits, a lot of the intelligence, a lot of the ability to synthesize higher level thoughts, this stuff starts really demonstrating itself once you get to field grade, because you're being placed into leadership roles. And the Air Force does in my opinion, a very poor job of recognizing that. The Army's not great about it either. I mean, and I've told you this before, the story is, or the narrative is, that the best officers in the military are the guys that top out at colonel or captain. And so don't start me laughing. Is that Greg coming in with Mark Milley? I mm-hmm. swear. he's made a comment here in the chat on the screen about Mark Milley being a superstar.
Oh God.
Don't get me started. Well, and see, so this is interesting, and I'm speaking historically now. I left active duty and was retired before what I consider to be the real politicization of the officer ranks occurred. And I started noticing it under Obama. When I say politicization, I mean one party or another, you know, doing becoming favored within the general officer ranks. And it's much more dramatic. I think it started under Obama, but that's when I really started to see, you know, retired officers taking one side or another in presidential elections, and all the assorted stupidity with that. And it started to be an issue with, you know, as certain political administrations began using the military for various social goals. You started to see this political alignment, and I think it's quite pronounced. It's highly problematic, obviously. You know, we have civilian control of the military, and that's been sacrosanct, but you saw Mark Milley doing some stuff that I think he should have been court-martialed for.
All right, or you got you and Greg got to go into that now. What did he do?
Well, for starters, he actively told the members of Congress that he was prepared to subvert Donald Trump and the president's actions if it was necessary. He reached out to his Chinese counterparts and told them that if any problems arose during the, you know, administration, he would alert them if he thought that something untoward was about to happen by back channel communication. He instituted full on the DEI and idiotic Black Lives Matter, you know, agenda within the ranks.
Supposedly he was the one who was telling Nancy Pelosi not to do the National Guard because Trump was trying to take
that's
over the country.
Latest. Yeah, that's the latest thing.
Well, I mean, again, it's not...
He circumvented executive branch control of the military.
Okay, it's sometimes, Lou, it's not what you say or how you say it, it's not how you say it. I mean, I think the question was, well, to me, trying to be normal on this, the question was, if we had a president, Trump or Biden, who looks like he's slipping too, if all of a sudden one of those guys said, you know,
nuke China, is there any sort of filter between him and the atomic bomb? I think is what the question should have been. But and I ask the same question, as we get people that are seemingly less and less capable of thinking like that. Is there some sort of, do you at least check? What was the movie with Gene Hackman? With the Alabama Crimson Tide. You know, are you going to just assume that's the order, or are you going to check it when you're bombing somebody? I mean, the question is there some sort of a common sense thing along the way? He said it all wrong, but
the military is not supposed to question those orders in the event of a clear-cut statement from the executive. The Secretary of Defense, who's a civilian, along with, I think there's one other person, are in the chain when the president, when the National Command Authority, that's the president, would issue an order to use, let's say, to use nuclear weapons. And the SecDef has the authority to short circuit that if need be.
We're talking about different things, though. We're talking about defense versus offense. So Milley was supposedly saying, don't bring the National Guard to the Capitol because they might turn on us.
He was. I consider him.
That was supposed to be defense.
Yeah, just the fact that he recommended Ibram Kendi and said, we need to start, dealing with this issue. In terms of how Ibram Kendi sees the world, was enough to make me think this guy's off the rails.
All right, back up here. How exactly, if the president orders something, does the Secretary of Defense say don't do it? Where's that written?
They have to agree.
They don't necessarily have to agree, but the Secretary of Defense is a buffer. If the president orders something, the Secretary of Defense is a civilian, is in that command chain, and he can short circuit that if he or she thinks it's necessary.
And this is where they could pull enough cabinet officials together. If they think the president is nuts, they can kick him out.
That's the 25th Amendment. Yeah, I mean, so a situation like that, here's the nightmare scenario. You want the president to be able to make a lightning fast decision on his own or her own if an attack comes. Because we could have as little as 6 minutes from the detection of launch to the detonation of a weapon over Washington, D.C., which would effectively decapitate the National Command Authorities. And so you want the president on the, woken up and said, okay, execute this plan, before we're all incinerated, execute this. And that order goes out and everybody plays ball. Alternatively, when you have some time, you want that collaborative decision-making process with the Secretary of Defense, the Vice President, and if that doesn't terrify you, having Kamala Harris in the loop on something like this ought to scare everybody. Never mind.
Well, nobody listens to her, so I mean, it's probably harmless.
Again, this is one of these deals. This is one of these deals where who knows what would happen, and this is the incredible danger of electing, politically motivated.
If the Secretary of Defense
motivated generals,
would he effectively resign if he didn't agree with it? He would say what he had to say and then make the president either fire him or resign or something.
That would be the optimal way to do it. Yeah. Alternatively, the Secretary of Defense picks up the phone and calls his buddy Mark Milley and says, it's time for a coup. And that's how one starts. So the
Joint
real
Chiefs
danger,
report to the president, though, right?
Everybody does.
For the military chain of command runs straight to the executive. The chief executive. But the idea is to have this kind of collaborative decision-making process on something like this, except when you don't have time to do so. And we kind of a Pearl Harbor kind of thing, we would probably not have time to do so if they were coming after, as I said, the National Command Authority.
Lou, just in terms of could somebody, last question before the break, could somebody really pop a surprise attack that we couldn't pick up any kind of chatter or anything before? I'm not saying it's impossible, but other than maybe from a submarine, I have to believe the amount of traffic and everything else.
Let me give you an example. Somebody smuggles some hostile power that wishes us evil, smuggles a 20 kiloton weapon, which is not very big, gets it shipped in across the border in Mexico or shipped in through a port, although the port security is pretty good. But if you seal this thing in lead and some other stuff and disguise it, you get it into the port, and then you put it on a truck and you drive it into the District of Columbia. And you know, it detonates. Is it possible to execute something like that without the chatter in the circuits? I think it is.
What was the book, Tom Clancy book?
Some of All Fears.
No, that was, was it?
Yeah.
Why did they blow that one up in Denver?
Denver was another one. Some of All Fears was Baltimore. Same idea.
Right.
You know, they roll a nuke in to take out a...
All they had to do was take a cargo ship and knock out the bridge.
Well, it yeah, that's right. So yeah, the short answer is yes, it's possible. It has been possible for, you know, several decades. I think it's, you know, it's not likely. We have lots of safeguards in place. But that would be one way of executing a decapitating
attack. Well, plus, we got a dasher, but it also, to a certain extent, we can count on, well, we didn't on 9/11, but we can count on the incompetence of the other side. That's a big operation.
Well, yeah, okay. So except when it isn't.
Yeah.
You know, except let's say you're a Russian oligarch, and you purchase within Russia, you purchase quietly a nuclear weapon. You know, a suitcase nuke from the bad old days. So you purchase this thing, and now you've got it, and you pick the phone up and you call, you know, henchman number one, and you say, I don't want anybody else, I don't want to know what about this, I don't want reports back. Your job is to get this smuggled into London.
Well, if the thing is 40 years old and it hasn't been, I thought the blasting caps and stuff were such that they had to be, they keep getting up. Is that, would that thing even work?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that would be one of the things you would tell your henchman to check.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to be on the end. We're hoping it wouldn't, but it seems like there's got to be some maintenance to these things. I mean, the plutonium never goes away, I don't think, but doesn't all the other stuff? I've read that these things need pretty serious maintenance, especially to get them things to go off. Anyway,
some of them do. Yes,
it's probably just on the rocket, not the actual.
Well,
the warhead needs the detonating mechanism for the warhead is pretty sensitive, and it needs help.
SP Futures up 6, NASDAQ Futures up 113. Be right back. Now we're blowing the world up here, for God's sake.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe, Greg Pappas. We got Lou Michaels with us. We've got, looks like Musk is going to win his $56 billion deal with no dividend. I how the hell people vote for that? I have zero idea, but anyway, that's what they do. Did you see that the over in Britain, they're going to, the Labour Party now says that they're going to concentrate on wealth growth. Isn't that interesting? What I don't know exactly. Britain's Labour Party pledges wealth creation as it targets landslide election victory. We're not talking about, you know, people making $100 a week or £100 a week and living on 90 and saving 10. We're talking about wealth creation like we're doing here by blowing the stock market up. It's wealth creation. I like that idea. We need to have some of wealth created for us, Greg. What do you think? Just saying. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 195. It's 1%. FTSE down 35.4. CAC around down 94, 1.2. So quite different direction than we're in. Over in Asia, Nikkei down 156.4%, Hang Seng up 174, 1%. So they're back up over 18,000, 18,112. Interesting how they can be up 174 when yesterday they weren't under 18,000, but I don't know, that's the number. Shanghai down 8.3%. So other than our NASDAQ here, nothing seems all that good today. Yesterday, we went flying up on the Dow was down 35, S&P up 45, and NASDAQ up 264, that's 1.5%. We just can't stop this stuff. We've had Apple, which got 90 gazillion shares outstanding, has been up, you know, $20 in like 2 days. Well, $20 times, great, after the traffic weather sports, figure out how many shares those guys outstanding. It's like $200 billion in market cap in like 2 days or some huge number. The bonds, down 2 basis points, 4.31. The Bund unchanged, 2.54. Japan down 1 basis point, back under 1%, 0.97. Oil down 54 cents, 77.96. Brent down 48 cents, 82.12. Very quiet in the oil patch, right in these high 70s. Natural gas down 5 cents, 2.98, back under $3. RBOB down a penny, 2.38. Gold down today, down 28 bucks. It was starting to rally up again, but not today. Fed projects just one rate cut in 2024. This whole concept of gold versus interest rates is sort of weird because when I started the business, the gold was at like record highs and the interest rates were 16%. So I don't know that everybody says there's a connection here. I'm not so sure there really is. Silver down a whole buck, 29.26. That's a big move for there. It's 3.3%. Copper down 3 cents, 4.53. We have the euro is at 107.9, so the euro dollar is a little stronger there. British pound, 127.7, kind of the same there. We've got Bitcoin down another 208 bucks, 67,848. What do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Morning, everyone. 6:38 here in Chicago. 75 degrees now, high of 86 today. Strong thunderstorms warning later today. Phoenix, 85, high of 108. Very warm today, breezy this afternoon. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 19 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook is 45 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 29 minutes. The Ryan from 95th, 20 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 33 minutes. Sports, MLB, Cubs beat the Rays 4-3. Sox lost to the Mariners. That was 1-2. NBA Finals, Game 3, Celtics beat the Mavs. That was 106-99. And the Stanley Cup, Florida's up 2-0 Game 3 tonight. And that's played at Oilers. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
Well, I want to shift topics here for a little bit. And just as we see, it's interesting that the Brits came out this morning with that idea of wealth creation. I don't know if I ever talked you into reading William Kennedy's Freedom from Fear. But one of the chapters in there that I remember the most And I don't know why, just because it kind of is a history that I didn't realize, and most people don't realize. I mean, when I say most people don't, because nobody was alive now that was there. But during the, everybody thinks this crash of 29 was this, you know, incredible event that all happened out of the blue and nobody knew it was coming and blah, 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 blah. And yet, the gentleman in the book had a huge chapter regarding how the wealth growth was so narrow. And only people, I mean, you talked about, you know, for God's sake, a Duesenberg cost, like, what, how many $1,000s back then? I mean, how could anybody even have that kind of money? And how, you know, the whole idea of everybody was in the market, even the shoeshine boy was in the market. Well, yeah, the shoeshine boy might have been in the market that was the shoeshine guy in Times Square or someplace, or Grand Central Station, but not nowhere else. It was only like 7% of the country even owned stock or some. And he basically said that the entire 20s, that a lot of the country was not in a recession, it was in a full-out depression, that the agricultural group had been in a depression the entire decade. Exports were down, and it was only, you know, the headlines and the few people that had all the dough, even more concentrated than today, if that's even remotely possible. And one listener and a good friend came back from a trip from here to Florida, and he essentially drove, well, he did drive, and his kind of report back was, middle America, it seems like nobody has any hope. It's like nobody looks good, nobody smells good. The cars are junks they're driving. Everybody's drinking Coke and potato chips. This is, you know, it's a generalization, but it's an observation. And it's like these people don't act like things are ever going to be good for them just by the way they carry themselves. And I'm going to say is that true? I mean, if it's true, how far can 10% of the people just leave the other 90 behind before it can? If we do it better this time, if the Fed's all involved like they are, just, you know, maintaining wealth and you know, ignoring the incredible inflation they put on people, all they do is talk about inflation going forward. Well, inflation stops right here at zero, which it's not. If it did, everybody's still screwed because of the 40% rise in the last 3 years. And unless somehow miraculously everybody gets a 5% raise the next 8 years, which isn't going to happen, and the inflation is zero, nobody's ever going to catch up. Can this be ongoing, Lou, or is there going to be a 1929? And God, if there is, we sure as hell don't want the 10 years that followed. I mean, what can this stop on its own? Can we ever get the regular people moving up the chain like maybe they ought to be? I mean, is this what's causing this in your mind? I know it's a little out of your field, but what are you seeing?
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Good. I for a second there, I thought I was off the air. I think that we have to rework a couple of fundamental aspects of the culture, of the popular mainstream culture. One of them is our education system. We are, with the exception of the programs that are producing these elites and servicing the children of the elites, we're doing a terrible job at educating. And it shows across the board. It's one of the issues here that we have in Colorado, that we have a very well-developed and crucial high technology center here in Colorado, built in many cases around the military, around DOD.
How did those guys just branch off a second, man? How did Denver become such a hotbed of that? Were they always, or is this new?
Well, it's relatively new. There was a couple of things. First of all, the Colorado School of Mines is a fantastic, I mean, it's an MIT here, and I don't use that term lightly. It's an MIT here at the base of the Rocky Mountains. The kids coming out of that program are absolutely top flight, and they're recruited to be top flight. So that started generating a lot of interest. The University of Colorado has a superb aeronautical and astronautical engineering operation. This is all within the last 40 years, I would say.
It doesn't make a difference. But is that a 4 or 5 year program?
It's a 4 year program that I know of.
Okay, because it was 4 at Notre Dame, it was really tough. But Ohio State, it's 5, and it's tough there too.
So that developed. You had the Air Force Academy doing its thing down in Colorado Springs. But at the same time in Colorado Springs, the Air Force began to leverage the Cheyenne Mountain Complex into this operation that has now become a separate service, the Space Force. And that drove a lot of federal money and technology development into Colorado Springs. Buckley Air National Guard Base, because it was close to this technology center here in Denver, and Buckley sat on the outside of Denver, and it was a guard base. There was nothing special happening there.
They're pretty big.
They started moving space resources into Buckley, and it now is a full up operational military installation. But again, with the triple fencing and triple wire around their space operations complex. So all of this starts coming in here, this funding, this high technology, the aerospace industry funds it, moves in, follows the money, follows in quickly. But the local schools here, were Denver, Denver schools, and they weren't capable of keeping up with this. They weren't capable of producing products that could work in these environments. And it was a huge issue, and it's one of the reasons why you saw the gold rush come out here, people trying to move out here, because there were a lot of well-paying, high-technology jobs that were available that the local school system simply could not support. So I think education is the first underpinning. The second underpinning is we have to figure out how we're dealing with the drug issue, and again, I use Colorado as a model. Colorado effectively legalized. They basically made it a misdemeanor that doesn't get prosecuted. Possession of small amounts of virtually anything. Again, we talk about ideologues running our government operations, and this is an example. When an ideologue is confronted by reality, the ideologue doubles down on whatever it is they're doing.
Read Mayor Johnson.
I realize you guys are at ground zero of this. Denver is getting there, but the idea was that if we decriminalize drugs, we'll remove the stigma of drug abuse, and we'll make it so that people will seek help. And the short answer to that is no. People just seek more drugs. And that's what it's been happening in San Francisco. It's happening here. I assume it's happening in Chicago.
But not as much. New York. I don't know if you're listening the other day. Our girl, our former producer Jessica called, and she lives in New York, and she's actually interviewing for CNBC, and she's telling me how bad it is. She lives in where the hell is? What's the difference between Queens and Astoria? Is Astoria part of Queens? I'm not big on New York geography, but. Anyways, that's where she lives, and she says you're basically tripping over people and needles and everything going to the subway.
Oh, yeah. And so we're allowing 70,000 people a year, I think that's the number now, to overdose. Our mortality, our average age of mortality has been dropping, which is unheard of for a Western country, in large part because of this. So that's an issue. We have to get our arms around the drug issue. But mostly I think we need to look at education. We need to look at how we put our people in. We have to understand that education is a strategic asset. And we need to move people into the right jobs. We need to stop with the idea that everybody has to go to college to get a lousy degree that qualifies them to serve coffee at Starbucks. We've always thought that the economy would make this adjustment, but with the government intruding so significantly into our economy,
the government
is altering the kind of economic incentives that would normally self-correct this kind of thing.
How do people, when somebody becomes an ideologue or has the politics that they are, I don't see how talk about the guy when he's not here, but the mayor of Chicago, the man is not an idiot. I mean, he must understand, even though he can, you know, as a community organizer, has a whole different skill set than maybe you and I do. But he has one. I mean, he has a skill set. I mean, not, you know, we're not mayor. He is. But they must understand that to attract, you know, some big, whether it's defense, whether it's I want to say drug companies, but I mean somewhere in the medical field. I mean, what is going to replace, you know, the U.S. Steel, the Rheem manufacturing in Chicago? Where are we going to get 200,000 high-paying jobs that all of a sudden every restaurant and bar and everybody else can now essentially lean at? And so the 200,000 becomes 800,000, and all of a sudden you have a real city again. They must realize that part of that, a real huge part of that, is human capital, which means people that are capable of doing this kind of stuff and are built. I'm not so saying that they already have the skills, but they have the ability to learn. I mean, it seems to me that when my family, they're all dead forever, but those guys came out of high school, and my mother came out of high school with this skill set. They all became tool and die makers. They became welders. They had one guy was installing huge printing presses. Would have not even a high school education. They somehow along the way, in those days, you at least learned to learn or something. I mean, now why we don't seem to have any of that? How people are not dumber starting out anymore? I don't think.
No, it's our national education culture, the schools that are producing, you know, teachers or whatever, are not focused on that kind of skill set. Do you know the one place, the most effective education operation we have in the United States? You know what it is?
Well, I have no idea.
Columbia.
U.S. military.
Well, oh yeah.
You take kids out of these crappy high schools and these terrible environments, and you give them 6 weeks of basic training. They come out of that organized, understanding what they're supposed to do, and then they go to tech school, and they're trained up. And educated into a skill, whether it's, you know, maintenance on something or driving something or whatever, but we have the most effective training program in the country. The military has the most effective training program in the country.
What?
And the guys that come out of that program are guys who will typically, I mean, when they come out of one of these tech schools, these are, for the most part, kids that will show up to work on time, properly attired, understanding that they've got a job to do, they know how to get it done, or they've been trained to understand how to study, how to make work, you know, make things work. They've been trained how to improvise. They've been encouraged to improvise, and they're ready to roll.
The
military uses them.
One of my questions that was in this Quora thing that I keep getting, where one of the questions was when Roosevelt died and Truman became president, didn't Churchill, who was, I guess, extremely well educated, didn't he look down on Truman? And the response was, Truman was almost as big a reader as Churchill. Don't ever underestimate what secondary education in the 30s or in the 20s was like in Chicago or in this country. It was real rigorous. He was no dummy at all.
Yeah, well, The model of education at that point was, we have to produce people who can service this economy that we've got going. We have to produce people who are productive members of society. Our education culture is not focused on that anymore. Our education culture as a culture is focused largely on and tolerates a tremendous amount of social activism in lieu of learning. And if you don't believe me, pull up a copy of the Free Press. There's an article in the Free Press this morning talking about the absolute craziness that's going on in local curricula, even in areas that are considered to be reasonably conservative. So, for example, you have a school in Florida using maps of the Middle East with school children where Israel doesn't exist. Because the teacher is a pro-Palestinian activist.
How did somebody get away with it? Why don't you teach what the real map is?
Well, because they don't believe that that's important. Other people can do that. The most important thing is to get this social activism activated.
Well, you know, I never saw
these people agents for social change. That's
never,
the most important thing.
I never saw any of that. I mean, Notre Dame was, at the time, under Hesburgh, was the best.
Oh, I mean, I saw it in high school. When I was in high school in the early 70s, I had teachers who were very pro-Democrat Party, who were very pro-social justice, and they pushed that within the classes. And it's
Catholics were always...
I got myself in trouble because I called one of them out.
Well, Catholic schools were always pro-social justice, but not... It was treating people normally and treating people with respect. It had nothing to do with this other stuff. But the only thing different they did is they brought in one of the brothers in high school. This was right around 1967, would have been what war was at. They brought in and the place was the news was very pro-Israel. Guy just brought in somebody who was from Palestine and just gave kind of his side of the story. It was not, and then he left. It wasn't like they taught it or anything. All he did was say that, be careful what you read in the news because it's not all exactly what's going on. And he was saying that his family was outside the original borders given to Israel by the UN. And in the space of 3 years' time, they were told to move another couple miles like three times. I mean, he said this is just what happened. And I think some of that did happen. I mean, there's always another side to the story. They never came in and said, by the way, here's a map of the place with Israel gone. And we never did anything like that. It just was another side of the story. And he was there one day, and the other stuff was there the whole rest of the time. So it's not like he carried the day.
Well, I'm just saying that this is a fundamental disconnect between people like you and me who look at these... situations in middle America and in places where we've got these hollowed out towns and say, you know, where are the jobs? And the short answer is there are jobs there in many cases. There just aren't people there to work them. And we're not training. Our education culture, the culture of our education colleges, teachers' colleges, is not producing people and not aimed at producing people who can do that.
Well, when you mess around with the economies of places, though, if you have if you have a plant moved to Mexico, say, or something or other, and all of a sudden it's gone, you can certainly take out one of these small towns. I mean, there's no question that in South Bend it's still reeling from the Studebaker Bendix fiascos. I mean, and it's been 50, 60 years, for God's sake. I mean, you sort of don't come back from that. Those are decisions made from on high. They're not. They might not even be economic, type of thing. And then you're left with, you know, now what do? We're going to work? No, we're not. I mean, I guess everybody can move, but not everybody can move. It's why if ever you're hanging around Northeast Indiana, might want to go to the Auburn Duesenberg Cord Museum. By the way, the cars are just spectacular. But the history of automotive industry, which really everybody says it's centered in Detroit, the first years it centered Indiana. There were something like 17 different car makers in Indiana. I mean, it was really the place. And aerospace the same way with the Wright brothers. Indiana's been a hotbed of a lot of stuff. Well, actually, Wright brothers, Ohio, but that area of the Midwest was really the cradle of a lot of industry, right? And but then you look around in Auburn, and here's a town where there's nothing around it. There's a bunch of farms, and it's this little town, and you can sit there and go, wait a minute, there used to be how many thousand people working in this factory producing these cars, and they are spectacular. You put those things next to a car today, and you sit there and go, wow. Even you and I can get lucky driving around in Auburn, maybe. You know,
You don't even need to do that. Drive around the southern and eastern shore of Lake Michigan and look at those towns there, like St. Joseph and places like that. That were huge manufacturing centers.
But my point is that all of a sudden, in the last year, it lasted a little more than 29. I think in 1930 they produced 11,000 cars. Now these cars are a lot of money. And all of a sudden, 1932, when they were down to like 2,500 cars, the economy was horrible, and the place shut down. Lou, it's down. It's dead. There isn't a person working there that now would be making $40 an hour. They're right back to this little community, and nobody, I'm sure, knows how to put a car together. Once you lose this stuff, you'll lose it. I mean, Pullman, for God's sake, how many people worked there when I was there? A couple thousand? Now there's a Walmart there, for God's sake. I mean, once you lose it, you lose it.
I don't have a problem with industries developing and changing and you know, moving along. What I have a problem with is our educational system's inability to adjust to that, and its unwillingness. And again, this is ideology at work. Its unwillingness to come in and do the kind of vo-tech training that Kevin talks about, and the kind of skill set that allows people to move into these manufacturing and you know, what we would consider to be traditionally blue-collar jobs. I don't think of them as blue-collar jobs anymore.
I don't either.
Because, frankly, the level of education and skill that's required to work on a lot of the equipment that I have people working on is way past that. But we don't train for that.
Chicago had to be the... If you drop back 40, 50 years and looked at the Chicago education system, you would say there is no one in the country anywhere near as good at Chicago at doing just that. And now we don't do any of that, or very little of it. CVS was 5,000 students learning all that stuff without even a college prep program. 5,000 people in one place.
Well, you know where they learn it now? In the military.
Yeah, well.
Effectively.
All right, well, we got a dash. Are you guys the snow cap? How did it end up? Are we going to fill up Lake Mead this year or what?
No, but there's a lot of water coming down out of the mountains right now because of these high temperatures. So you're getting a lot of quick melt. The water's adequate this year.
Not great, but okay.
Yep.
All right, adequate. But you take care of yourself. Have a good week. Win all your cases. Make sure. How often do you wear that black suit?
More often than I'd like, actually.
Oh. I bet you could step right in and become a bereavement counselor with that thing.
Probably.
Okay.
given the way I felt yesterday, yes.
Yeah, I know. That's a shame. Anyway, RIP again. Lou, take care of yourself. We'll be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 7. NASDAQ Futures up 117. The 5 or 6 stocks, just get on them. We're going right to the moon. You'll be wealthy beyond the dreams of avarice, as they say. Do we have Mr. Dan?
Yes.
Dan, did you see this article here? Treasury Secretary Yellen, Dan Janitis' great aunt, says says U.S. debt load is in a reasonable place if it remains at this level.
Okay. Oh, you gotta be kidding me. I did not see that, but...
Now, here we have Greg Pappas with us. And Greg, the last time you checked, and I'm sitting here watching the U.S. debt clock spinning like a top, when's the last time you checked, what are we, $1 million in every 34 seconds or something like that?
Does it matter?
Well, she says if it remains at this level.
Well, it's like if saying, you believe it, it's not a lie.
It's like saying, I'll do what if something remains this way? I mean, what are we talking about? Everything will be great. Everything will be great here in Chicago. It won't rain if it stays like this, but it's not going to stay like this. It's going to rain. What am I missing? How could you even say that?
You're not missing anything. I totally agree. I think it's absolutely nuts. Yeah, there's definitely a problem with the, and that I think, Chief, is going to be the, that's going to be the issue coming up after the dust settles from election year is just where we really stand with the debt level, not only the national debt level, but even household debt level and credit cards and all that. I mean, that's something that's been, I don't know if I want to use the word ignored, but it has not been given enough attention. So that's, I think, our concern going forward.
Well, how long do you think the man, meaning Mr. Powell, can get up there in front of people and basically tell everybody there's no problem?
Jerry, just remember, it's not a lie if you believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, how long can we say that the inflation rate is this, and maybe it's 2% or 2.5 or whatever? Once in a while, he'll say something about, yeah, well, it's still in home services and stuff. There has to be some recognition that virtually everything important people buy is 35%, 40% higher than it was 3 years ago.
Yeah, no, and again, I absolutely agree with you on that. Some of the points that he made, because I listened to his speech yesterday and then the questions, and some of the points he was making. There was one woman, I can't remember which group, but one of the reporters was asking questions about the impact, day-to-day impact for people who were, lower, not necessarily lower income, but sort of your middle class people who are dealing with their expenses going up and continuing to go up. And he dodged around it. And then finally he says, yeah, you know, there is some discrepancy here. I mean, it's not some discrepancy. There's a major discrepancy. And these are the people who are the working people who are out there just trying to make a living. So no question about it. And no question about the fact that inflation's an issue. Now, the CPI number came out and it looked good. And that's why the market has rallied. The good news I would say about all this is that if we see a gradual decline in inflation, that's good. If we were to see a sudden sharp decline, then that actually probably would not be the best thing. So there's some good news about the fact it's been gradual, but as you're saying, and I agree, if you look at the expense side of people's balance sheet, it's up there. And in a couple of other questions that came up yesterday were regarding shelter and what I guess they basically mean housing costs. And housing costs are still very, very high. There's still an affordability issue.
It's never been picked up in the CPI properly.
Exactly.
Neither is medical stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Ex-food, energy, and all those other important things, right?
Well, Dan, I'm going to take a second here and give the way the CPI is generated, all right, and this is assuming it's straight, which I'm coming to absolutely convince that it's not. First of all, the number was 0.2, not zero, and they adjusted it to zero. Now, who's the adjuster? We're going to do this until the election, then all of a sudden after the election, we're going to have an adjustment the other way. But somehow, I thought that this rent part would have to catch up at some point. Now they're not even letting it catch up. But let's say, for instance, the if they were straight, the medical piece would be 6% of the basket, and all of a sudden some huge thing happens where all of a sudden an emergency room visit instead of 5,000 is now 20,000. Okay, now this is going to hit the CPI, but it's only going to hit it to like 6%. But now somebody might say, okay, going forward the medical stuff is now 12% of the basket, but it stays at this new level for a while. Now it actually is a detractor on the inflation going forward, but you still haven't made up for the fact that it tripled in 1 month. You never the way it's set up, you never catch up. Another stupid way of saying it is if your town never has a parking fee to park in front of your own house, and all of a sudden 1 year it's $1,000, and you sit there and go, what the bleep? Well, that's probably not even in the CPI, so it doesn't even count. So maybe next year you put it in the CPI, and it doesn't change for 10 years. Well, now it's a piece of the CPI that doesn't move up. So now it never was counted in the beginning, and now it's zero inflation. So the number, even if you did it properly, unless you have some sort of a look back and say, where are we? I mean, someplace somewhere, Dan, you would think, and maybe it'll be after the election, who knows, but someplace somewhere, somebody has to say, hey, guys, we're 4 years into this, 5 years into this, we've got rent going up a total of 15%, and by the way, every other place in the country says it's 40. Are we going to come clean ever? Is the answer no?
The interesting thing is, well, there's a couple things, a couple points. One is that the Federal Reserve in the past had been a little more anticipatory, which is what we are as investors. We're looking forward. We're not looking back. We're looking forward to see what's happened. And what they're saying now, you know, what they've been saying since they, you know, kind of messed up a few years ago, made the wrong call. What they're saying now is we're data dependent. And I understand their level of conservatism. Like, I can understand them being conservative. However, as you're saying, and I totally agree, the data that they're looking at is not relevant. We also got to be very careful, I think, as investors in looking at, like, paying too much attention to that data. Now, the only reason it could make some sense is because the investing public that does listen to that, they're the ones who are driving the market. But I tend to still look around, as you do, and look at what's going on day to day. What are we observing? I do a lot of questions with people in different industries. We talk to a lot of the CEOs of the companies we invest in. And that's really how you get your information, what's going on. Looking at the data that's already old, and again, the compilation of that data, we have to be very careful, I think, to make our decisions based on that. And I think it's going to continue because Powell says the exact same thing each time. We're data dependent. We want to see maximum employment. We want to see price stability. Everybody wants to see maximum employment and price stability. But the one thing I took away from the meeting yesterday is there's still some confusion on the labor side as well. And there's some confusion on what's going on there. And I caught the last part of the discussion with Lou earlier, talking about training. And one big discrepancy on the labor side is that, yeah, there are, you know, things are coming in better balance. Unemployment is ticking up a little, which isn't so bad. But there's going to be this part of the labor force that's going to be missing going forward. It's you know, some of it will be made up with immigrants, but there's less training, there's less education. A lot of companies have told me it's not a lot. I mean, almost every company says it's very hard to hire good talent, and then they're not providing the training and that skill. So we're going to have a problem on the labor side as time goes on. On the other side of that, the baby boomers who are still working are getting paid a lot of money to hang in there. So people in all industries are holding on to the older guys and the older woman who've been in the industry for so long. That is going to create a problem with employment. So right now, looking at the data going back, it looks like one thing, but nobody's talking about what's going to happen going forward. And that's what we need to do as strategists, as investors. So I would tend to agree with the point that you guys were making earlier that this is an issue, but it's a bigger issue when you're actually looking at the numbers.
Well, I think that most of the time, you and I are. Clearly, you want to look forward.
Yeah.
But you can't look forward if the numbers behind you are wrong, and just say we're only looking forward.
You can't base your predictions of the future on the numbers that we have right now.
Right. I mean, the numbers are so awful that you can't even, I don't see how you even do that.
interesting thing too about the meeting yesterday is, you know, they were talking about, you know, the average, member was saying that we'd have one cut. So that I think it averaged out to one cut, meaning one cut in interest rates for 2024, and then possibly four cuts in 2025. Well, and this is where I really agree with you, because the predictions that we would be in a recession didn't happen, and that was based on data that they were looking back at. And the predictions that there'd be multiple cuts this year didn't happen. And I've been saying all along that they weren't going to happen, but I'm looking at other sources of information to make my decisions. I'm not looking at the same data that they're looking at.
Well, by the definition of the recession they're going by, and the amount of money they've poured in the economy, and the fact that the stock market runs up and the wealth bubble continues to move, in their mind, the numbers will never show a recession. Yet we could have 90% of the people in this country worse than they were last year, and it will never show. So the whole idea of the term recession, I think we should scrub out of the dictionary at this point. And I know that's not what anybody wants to say, but the number becomes useless to me at this point. It totally is.
And I totally agree. The definition, the historic definition of a recession is two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. And we already had that, shortly after the pandemic. And that was, again, that was ignored. I don't think that's likely to happen. One thing I will say that's on our side, from the beginning of the year, I was saying, our annual letter at the beginning of the year said we were in a strong economy, a stronger economy, that we would see the markets would do well. And part of what I base that on is just all the money sitting on the sidelines. And the money that's sitting on the sidelines is not with retail investors, it's with institutional investors like me, who, and this is our strategy on the fixed income side, but if you're getting paid 5.5% to be in short-term T-bills, you look at your risk-adjusted return, and it's pretty high relative to being in stocks that are overvalued or inflated. So, but this money's going to come into the market, and this is the positive that I'm seeing going forward for the market, is that as short-term rates come down, people are going to be looking to redeploy that cash. But a lot of institutional managers, and especially those who manage money for like foundations, endowments, they're saying, if we're getting 5.5% right now in T-bills or short-term treasuries, that's pretty good. And we don't know that we want to take that risk, because we have, we don't want to go back to the board and say, the board of directors and say, we're...
By the way, I agree with you, but the Qs are up 5.5% in the last 3 days.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about.
You're talking about rational people, but I'm saying, the idea that we have investors, and investors are not all you and me. I mean, clearly they're not. Why, if everybody habitually, I don't know if you watch the market all day long, I think you do, but you're focused more on the fixed income, but. The amount of mutual fund buying on the close the last 10 days has been astronomical. Now, to the people who have been in the market the last 15 years, if everybody just keeps buying and nobody ever sells, regardless of PE, regardless of revenue per share, regardless of anything like that, what could ever go wrong, and why won't we all be rich?
That's the mentality. And that it's also the fear of missing out. And I even saw... I was thinking a little bit about that yesterday as well, because several strategists, there are people who a lot of the people who are on the Bloomberg and the CNBC and the Fox Business News, there are people who are skeptical and somewhat cautious the way we are. But then there's a lot more people who are saying, that are really focusing on AI, and they're focusing on the potential and all that. There's that fear of missing out that is continuing. But I still think more of that's coming from the retail side than the institutional side. I think a lot of institutional managers, because that's what I've done most of my career, managing foundations, union money, public pension plans, you know that you have to report back to the board, and you don't want to come back and say, hey, you know, we put 20% in growth stocks and it, you know, we timed it poorly. Because that's the retirement money for a lot of people, or that's money that's going to the, you know, the endowment or the foundation. So there's a level of conservative investing, which I think right now does make sense.
I'm with you. I'm just playing the part of the advocate. If you're on national TV, I'm looking here at all day long, they're going to talk about the second these guys lower these rates, this market is going to get out of its lethargy, and it's going to go straight up. I'm looking here at February 2022, the close when the interest rates were 0.08. All right.
Yeah.
The close on the S&P was 436. May of 2024, with the rates at 533, the close is 527, and it's up again today. So we're talking roughly 90 points, which has got to be, what, 20-30%?
No, absolutely. And you're right on point because the cost of capital is much higher for these companies, and especially for the tech companies. They're the ones that are most negatively impacted by, you know, borrowing costs, which are definitely higher. And when you hear the Fed, you know, when you say that they're only expecting maybe one rate cut this year, and four of the people on the Fed committee said no rate increases, and I'm still somewhat in that category. Why would investors be looking at these tech stocks and saying that they're not going to be impacted, or companies in general, and not think that they're going to be impacted by
cost of capital? But this right now, it's if they drop from 533 back to 5, you ain't seen nothing yet. We're going to see a CrowdStrike, or we're going to see Microsoft double, even though the company's worth $90 gazillion. You're going to see Apple up how many percent in 4 days because they came out and said they're going to do some wacky stuff. What about the guys in Oracle the other night? They came out with crummy earnings, top and bottom line. Okay, and then they said, oh, by the way, we got some kind of partnership going forward with this AI firm. All of a sudden, the stock was up 12%.
Boom. Yeah. I mean, it's not based on so much what the concerns would be for these. It's just this irrational exuberance, right? They called it just like people thinking this is like the next. But that, you know, that's where I go back to retail, because I think a lot of the retail investors, and again, a lot of these chief are people that are our age who have retired, that are now doing, you know, that have accumulated all this wealth, and they're saying, okay, I can do this myself, right? Because I've made money in Nvidia, and I've made money in Oracle, and I've made money in Apple. So they're saying, I'm good at this, I can do this myself. And I know people who are doing this, and I have some clients whose spouses are doing this. And you get to a point where they have suddenly decided that they're gurus in this, but they've only started having the time to spend on it since retirement. So I think that represents a lot of the people who are pushing the market higher in this environment. It's certainly, I mean, it's some younger people, but the younger people are saving their money to afford a home.
I think it's the older people that are way out on the risk curve and are making money and are loving it. But the thing of it is, the mentality is you and I are not afraid to be a little early and being a little more conservative on stuff we've made money. That's a mortal sin with these people. If you don't get the absolute top, you're doing a bad job. I mean, if you bought Nvidia, well, now that it's split, if you bought Nvidia at 10 and you sold it today at 128, which is, it would be up another $29 if you sold it today at 128 and tomorrow it traded 129, you screwed somebody.
It's interesting that I think there's much more of this do it yourself environment, but if you, like I said, if you've made money, you know, I have one friend who keeps bragging about how much he's made and these names, and I said, oh, that's great. Okay, so next time at dinner, it's your treat at dinner next time. You know, there's something that's also changed. I think a behavioral thing that's changed in our world, and it's not necessarily globally, because I think there are certain countries that still have a lot of respect for their elders and a lot of respect for professional people that have experience, but we've lost some of that. And I think people are thinking they can do everything on their own now, and that includes investing. And the other thing that's pretty obvious that it includes is people who are remodeling homes, which has been a big thing, you know, doing this all yourself. So now they're semi-retired and they're thinking, oh, I can do this myself. So, but, and I had dinner with a contractor friend of mine last night, and we were discussing that whole dynamic and how there's a challenge, even though they've been busy, his firm has been busy, it's still this challenge because people will question, or they'll think they have the answers to all this rather than looking at the authorities.
Yeah, they got the internet.
Yeah, they've got the internet, right. They've got a YouTube video that'll show them how to redo their plumbing. So, you know, they can do it better than the plumber who's got 30 years of experience. You know, I still believe strongly in going to the expert who does something all day long, because you're gonna start managing your money in retirement. You're gonna start being that person who's retired at, let's say, age 65 and saying, oh, this is fun, this is easy, I've made money in all these stocks. But then you're gonna, you know, take a little break or go on a little trip or something and over to Europe, and you're gonna come back and say, oh, what happened? You know, I missed that. Oh, do I have to be, you know? So that, you know, and then the other thing that we know, because we've been doing this so long, is certainly I look at all the accounts every single day. However, you can't look at short-term movements. You can't rely on short-term movements. And I think a lot of the do-it-yourselfers are doing just that. So they're really upset and depressed on the day when the market's down and their NVIDIA stock is down. Well, that's not, you know, you have to have a long-term outlook. You cannot get caught up in the minutiae and the day-to-day. And as my mother used to say, though, you know, some people have too much time on their hands. You got to be really careful when it comes to our business, because there's a lot of risks and there's a lot of there's a lack of understanding is what I'll
say.
Dan,
the mentality? I don't think the only difference is this time is you have a bazillion people with you telling you on CV to buy the stuff, and you have people but I don't see. I mean, it's been so long since I've done it, but I was somewhat of a researcher in the original railroad companies. They were fly and burn. They were the original TV companies. They were up and whatever. Not to mention the 2000 dot bomb fiasco. I mean, people have always had this mentality. I've got it figured out. It's different. All I do is put money in this, and it just runs up every day. I mean, there's no. We've been in business a long time. We had clients during the 2000 where, I mean, we had people that had worked for one of these dot bomb places. You know, I use that term because some of them never really had anything,
right.
And they were. We had a guy who we had stock in a company that he had here. And he's long gone, so I can say it. And he would use that to sell puts in the company. And oh, by the way, his 401k at the company was all the company stock. I mean, you know, you couldn't. I said, you know, hey, maybe you should be thinking of buying some of these puts and protecting this rather than selling more. No, if it goes down, this company's only going north. I mean, there's only one way with this thing. We're going to be on top of the world. We're going to be the new whatever. And you know what? Place went out of business, and so did he. And, you know, there was never any thought. But there's only so much you can say as a broker. You just say, you know, aren't you supposed to be, like, buying puts and not selling them? Duh.
Yeah.
You know,
it
doesn't matter. I mean, it's some people. Right now, the people are convinced that whatever happens. I mean, Jay Powell yesterday never once said, I mean, if you're listening to think that this rally should keep going way beyond where it should, now whether it's there now or whether it's there somewhere, really, but at a percent or two a day, which is really what we're doing in the NASDAQ here, at some point, a CrowdStrike where it's 25 or 30 times revenue has some weight. Now, I don't know the company well enough. They could be growing that fast. They could be, but they're not all growing that fast. When you start getting to those levels, at some point you sit there and go, I don't know. But if you're just playing a momentum, I mean, for God's sake, look at Bitcoin. It's worth nothing in a trade. It's an artificial stock in a trade. When there's too much money in the system, that's what happened with the tulips. And all of a sudden, now if you'd be able to borrow, I mean, I would say right now that if somebody was long, somebody, if a lot of people long NVIDIA all along the way here, if it starts to go down, they're not going to sell, Dan. They're going to use their margin to buy more. That's why
exactly what's driving the continue. It's, you know, the money that they've made goes into making more money, putting it back into the same stock. Yeah, this is going to get me rich. And it's that naivety, I think, or lack of experience that I think in this momentum part of the cycle is going to continue, is what's going to make it continue to run up until, as you're saying, the money supply comes back into balance, and it's just not there yet.
Well, it's not going to, because
it isn't.
Every person around the world is looking at ways. I mean, the British government, or the Labour Party now, who's running against the other guys, they think they're going to win. They're talking about wealth creation. How do you create wealth? You drop the value of your dollar, so everybody has more dollars. I mean, Japan's doing the same thing. I mean, China's doing the same thing. Everybody is.
Right.
And it's all, and the question is, how far is it going to go? Because one thing there's very, very few things that I say, Dan, that are absolutely true. But here's one of them. If you got a stock or a market that doubles and then drops back down to where it was, you think people are even. They're not. You lose more money on the way down than you made on the way
up.
Absolutely. Because the margin continues
to
grow.
It's not a symmetric relationship. You lose a lot more when it goes down, percentage-wise, too. So when it goes up 10%, when you lose 10%, you got to lose, you got to go up 11% in order to make that happen. Those are obviously concerns, and I also think another concern is people looking at the wrong, as we've been saying, data, or looking at the wrong information, or listening to the wrong, people that they've decided are their gurus. And I know Ken Polkari and I share this idea that you got to be really careful not to put. And I'm not going to say anything negative about her necessarily, but Kathy Wood, for example. Well, Kathy is saying that, this is what's happening with NVIDIA, and this is what she believes. Well, I've been a portfolio manager my whole career, and trying to be an expert in every company that you have in your fund is hard. You rely on analysts, you rely on other people for that information. You got to be really careful about not finding a guru, because they will all have their day, and they'll have their corrections, as her fund did, the ARK fund did as well, the ARK ETF, I should say, did as well. You've got to just be very careful about that. What I would recommend to listeners is to have multiple sources of information. So if you're going to listen to, don't just listen to one show or one, read one publication. Make sure that you read several, and then also, more importantly, read the industry information and the specific company information. Go to the company's website. With friends who are in different industries, they always get a little bit nervous around me when we're talking about, they'll say, oh yeah, I made all this money, and this one guy was talking about Baidu, the Chinese company, and said, oh yeah, yeah, I've just decided. And I said, well, I can send you some research reports on it that I have access to that you wouldn't have access to. You can make up your own mind. Some of them are buy reports.
They don't want
some
any
of them are sell reports. Didn't want to read it.
They don't want any sort of negative vibes on the
there
stock.
There you go.
Because you might actually affect the stock by having some negative vibes.
Right.
We got to go to the break. But did you ever see the? I forget what movie it was in. Man, and everybody, there's a huge scene at this crap table, and everybody is the thing. Three people deep. There's money all over the table. And this guy's got this big roll going, right? And all of a sudden, some kind of, I use the term, ditzy young blonde wanders up and puts $5 on the don't pass line. For those who don't know what that means, it means you're betting against the roller and not with him. The look on everybody's face. Sure enough, the next one, the guy wings a 7 and the dough's all gone. I mean, not all gone. They were still up. But just to look and, wait a minute, there's a negative vibe in this place. What is going on?
Somebody has a different point of view, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the thing is, I think we have to balance all the points of view when we make our decisions. And we can't strictly stick to one thing. But, there's something great about optimism. And I, like to think of myself as a glass half full guy. But there's also, when you're managing money for institutions, which is what I've done most of my career, there's something called risk management. And risk management is a really important part of our business. And I kind of think of myself as protecting my clients' money, protecting their assets. And that's the importance of what we do, Chief. That's our role. And yet, I think in some ways, it's become less significant because we're the reminder to a lot of do-it-yourself investors that, oh yeah, we lived through the periods where there were downturns. And by the way, there are certain ways to protect your portfolio during those downturns. But they, but you're right, they just don't want to hear that. They yeah.
Dan, and there was, I mean, I'm going to go way back to 1982 when the bull rally started. We were so far behind, you know, at 800 in the Dow, and the interest rates were so high that when the interest rates went from, you know, 16 to 14 to 12 to 10, you actually, even though you already had some huge rally, you could sit there and go, you know, if these rates go to like 7 or 8, like they should be, we're not even starting yet, gang. I mean,
right.
I mean that's
exactly.
But to think the same thing now, I then there was a reason to think we could go from 800 to 4,000. You know, we could go up 5 times because
right.
that was. But now, I mean, the idea that, I mean, we're talking. I've got the NASDAQ, the Qs, and the 13th of May, which is a month ago, basically, at 443. They're up 9% in a month. I mean, are we going to do that? Are we seeing Apple at like 500? Are we seeing, you know, where are we here? Are we really thinking Microsoft, as big as it is, they're already 13 times revenue, and they're the biggest company in the world, for God's sake, or second. Are we talking 1,000 here with the same revenue?
Type of research that we do, where we're actually talking to companies and we're talking to employees and we're talking to people in the industry, I think that's really where we get most of our information. And I love Amazon. As a consumer, I think it's a great business model. But I have friends and friends' kids who have lost their jobs and they've been cutting back. And I actually, what I'll do is I'll take a couple of them out for drinks just to like pick their brains and see what's going on. And these younger people who are really top notch, you know, like really good talent, are challenged right now because of what's happening in the industry. They're saying, you know, it's tough to get another job in tech. So there's another perspective out there, the inside perspective that they see, that also includes the corporate culture that's changed a lot in a lot of the tech companies that used to provide a lot of benefits that they're no longer providing. Friend that works for Oracle, who was given the opportunity to work remotely overseas, he was at a stage in his career where he should have been getting bonuses and pay raises. They've cut those out. So he negotiated to be able to do his remote work, you know, overseas for a few months. But there's if you got to see what's going on in the company, and when that employee morale starts going, it's going to be harder for them to retain talent and harder for them to attract new talent. And then I think the point that you guys made with you and Lou made earlier is that there's the training is just not there. There's going to be some issues with these companies down the road.
But are they so concentrated,
I don't think
Dan?
Put that side.
Are they so concentrated that Microsoft, if you were to say to the head of Microsoft, and these guys are, you know, the biggest monopolists I think that have been around forever that have never been prosecuted. If they say we've lost 8% of our customers, so what? We're just going to raise the prices 10%. I think that is people's
because
mentality.
Because the other customers will pay it.
Yeah,
Other customers pay it, they'll keep raising. Yeah, they'll have that mentality.
And I clearly believe
that. That happens at a Microsoft, and that happens at a small business as well.
Not as much. The guys you talk to are much more, I'll say, slaves to the competitive marketplace. Where Home Depot, in some areas, they raise the price wherever they want. So other areas they have, you know, there might be a Menards down the block or a Lowe's, but some areas not. And Microsoft, Home Depot, the same way. We went through the, you know, the COVID, for God's sake, and they came out last time and said how many less people are in the store, and the stock's up from there. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. And that those are things that I think are really important for investors.
Well, it's important we go to a quick break here, Dan. We'll be right back. S&P futures up 18 now. NASDAQ futures up 155. Just keep, you know, there's no such thing as a downtick. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Yeah.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Al. Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 14. NASDAQ futures up 143. We also have Mr. Dan Janitas, who is one of these reluctant kind of guys. He's not willing to say, just because people told him there is no inflation, that there is no inflation. Now, we gotta beat that out of him a little bit. Whatever he hears, that's the truth. This is George Orwell is at the helm here. Over in Europe, they're the other way. We got the DAX down 197. It's over 1%. Puts you down 26.3%. CAC around down 89, 1.14%. We come back. Let's make sure we ask Dan what this CAC around has got. It's down a bunch since they've had that election problem. They're supposed to get rid of they're going to disband the parliament over there. So they got to be down like 3% since that started. Over in Asia, mixed bag here. Nikkei down 156.4%. Hang Seng up 174, almost 1%. Back up over 18,000, but they've been sliding all week. Shanghai down 8.3%. So again, kind of not really telling you much over there. Yesterday here, Dow down 35, S&P up 45, NASDAQ over up 264, and we're up another 140 now. Maybe let's make it a 500. Let's just do it all at once. Let's go up 1,000. What's the difference? Bonds down 3 basis points, 4.27. The Bund down 2 basis points, 2.51. Japan down 2 basis points, 0.96. We've got oil behaving again, down 31 cents, 78.19. Brent down 24 cents, 82.36. Natural gas down 5 cents, 2.99. One of the pieces in the CPI was that oil was up last month and it's back down this month. So that's one of the reasons why the number came in where it did. Gold down 20 bucks, 23.34. Silver down 92 cents. That's a big move. It was down over a buck earlier, 29.34. Copper down a penny, 4.55. We've got U.S. dollar. 108 against the euro, so not much going on there. 127.8 against the pound. So whatever everybody's doing, they're all doing it together. Crypto, down 340, was down more than that earlier, 67,716. What do you got for us, Traffic Weather Sports? Cubs finally win, Sox.
Morning, everyone. 742 here in Chicago. 75 degrees now, high of 86 today. Strong thunderstorm warning in the afternoon. Phoenix, 85 now, high of 108. Very warm today, breezy this afternoon. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 32 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook is 48 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 38 minutes. And the Ryan from 95th is 23 minutes. Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 33 minutes. Sports, MLB beat the Rays. That was 4-3. Sox lose to the Mariners. That was 1-2. NBA Celtics beat the Mavs. That was game three. It's 3-0. And Stanley Cup tonight. Florida's up 2-0. Game three tonight. Panthers at Oilers. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
Wait a minute. You have one of the biggest stars in all of basketball died yesterday, Jerry West. Kevin and I will do a little something for him tomorrow.
Yes, Jerry West at 86 passed away. And also Caleb Williams launching his own investment firm. Not via PTI, but he's doing his own PE type venture deals.
Good for him. Maybe when he fails at quarterback, maybe he can do it.
He hasn't played a snap. He's already planning for
his future. Nothing wrong with that. I'll say that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I wish the guy all success in the world. But God, it's been three quarterbacks in the last 10 years we've been down this road with. All of them undersized. All of them, whatever. What are we gonna do if Justin Fields like has a huge year in Pittsburgh?
Laugh.
Yeah, laugh. So, yeah, it's
So, Dan, what in God's name is going on over in France?
I don't know. I thought you were going to ask me about the Celtics.
Oh, I could do that too, buddy. Those guys, they've got four or five guys. I actually think that Timberwolves, because they're a lot bigger, might have been a little more of a challenge for the Celts.
Yeah.
But this Kyrie Irving has not shown up, so.
Right.
That hurts.
I was just thinking prior to the break that, you know, we were talking about the mentality of sort of, I don't know, I the analogy that I had was fair, you know, I was watching the game last night being a Boston, you know, coming from Boston, but I'm a fair weather fan when it comes to basketball. But when it's your team, your hometown that you grew up in, that you're going to naturally have that. And I'm thinking, you know, fortunately, I'm not one of those guys that'll watch in the day that, you know, or the moment in the game where they fall behind that I'm going to get all depressed and upset. And if they do lose a game, I'm not going to get all depressed and upset. And I think there's, you know, again, I think there's a, you know, like a mentality in the investment world that can be similar if you kind of fall in love with the team. Or, I mean, if you're loyal to a team, I think that's great. But there's that, you know, and a lot of Boston fans are like this, that we get too, our expectations, because there's so many good, you know, sports teams there, and there have been in recent years, that we get cocky, maybe is the word, you know, about our sports team. So likewise, you know, the analogy is not getting too cocky and about your investments.
One of the local taps by me might be the official drinking hole of Stocks and Jacks, is a Boston bar, and I'm going to say about the most obnoxious group.
Absolutely.
And then not only that, if they're ahead and they fall behind, they immediately want to fire the coach. I mean, they turn in a nanosecond. And everybody's
fights in the stands. Yeah. Even in my high school hockey games, it'd be fights in the stands. You know, there's diehard and then there's Boston fans.
Everybody's a general manager. You know, everybody.
Yes.
Did you happen to catch that? I mean, you and I have talked a little bit. I've talked more with Kevin, I think. But all this idea of sports gambling and how for years and years, I remember when I was a kid and Paul Hornung got suspended and Alex Karras, and just the idea you were ever even seen with a gambler. And now it is so tight. We've had two people already now banned for life for betting, one baseball player, one basketball player. And there was an article the other day, and I don't know, Greg, did you send it around or did somebody did? It had to do with death threats now on people if they struck out, or people are yelling, I'm coming after your family. I mean, does anybody think that this is healthy?
Yeah, no, I agree.
I mean, I don't. There was a, I was a pretty serious 16-year softball player for a while, but we were never in a, and I played against some of the better teams and tournaments and stuff, and, you know, we didn't win or anything like that. But if you went to somebody's, there was one of the bastions of Chicago softball was either Kelly Park or Clarendon Park. One north side, one south side. And we were almost played in Kelly Park one night, and we wanted to be in the B League. And they said, we didn't have any room in the B League, but there was room in the A League. And then we were young. We were like 20-something. Now, these are with the Bobcats and all these other guys. And we're going, wait a minute. Well, you have to guarantee a minimum 200 or 400-hour wager per game, you and the other team. I mean, it was a big money thing. Well, if you umpired there, it was an up. He goes, you don't have to worry about the players. I mean, they're pretty okay. But the people in the stands are all betting too. And if there's a blown call, you wonder if you can get yourself out of there for $20 a game or 15, whatever it was at the time. And you know, this whole thing now that people are betting on every pitch. And why do people think the mentality? Okay. Human beings have changed. But the people in the stands. I mean, if you can get yourself out of there for $20 a game, or I'm hearing myself twice here. Right? Once is bad enough. You know, this betting on every pitch, and
it's that short-term focus, and that's kind of the way our world has gone, right? You know, to looking at something as short-term as a pitch, as opposed to looking at the season, maybe.
Well, the French thing is the evidently there's separate elections for the the Euro Parliament, and the party that's not in power. They didn't win. So Macron said, well, if that's what everybody feels, we're going to disband Parliament, and we have another snap election to see if people really still want us here, right? Isn't that basically the bottom line of the thing? Well, the French market's been down pretty heavy. But our market, I mean, what is what, if anything, is going to cause someday people to say, wait a minute, this stuff maybe is too high? I mean, maybe not. I mean, maybe not. Maybe they're going to grow into it. I'm just hoping if we grow into it, Dan, we better start growing pretty fast. That's all I'm saying. People better
that's actually a really good point and a good question. But and one thing I was going to bring up is, you know, we saw the BOE and the Bank of Canada do the same thing. I mean, the feds, if you will, Federal Reserves, if you will, in those countries, the banks, have already gone ahead and lowered rates, and they are not seeing the kind of economic boom, or they're not seeing the same kind of momentum, you know, in their markets that we're seeing here. So even though, and they may actually rely a little more on politics than we do, because especially in Europe, because I don't want to use the word socialist, but there's more of a connection, if you will, between the government and how their companies perform, you know, the stocks perform. So they're actually probably the smarter ones right now in terms of not being, like, not getting caught up in this momentum that we see here. And, you know, if anything, it might be the opposite. It might be almost a better investment there if you want to, like, start diversifying. People are saying, where do you put the money once this bubble has happened? Well, there's plenty of places overseas. I think Europe probably is a good example, France in particular.
Yeah, but you don't want to be in a position of making 10% on your stocks and losing 10% on the currency right back where you started from.
That's a good point as well. But I don't know where that's going either. I think that's a much tougher call. I give a lot of credit to the people who are currency managers, but it's just, I think that's a very, very tough
call. Dan, do you see, boy, I'm going to ask this question because I don't know the answer, and I think I should. If you were, say, you want to invest in Great Britain and actually, you know, convert your dollars to pounds and buy stuff over there, I'm sure there are, I mean, there's ETFs for everything, I'm sure there are ETFs here that you can buy in U.S. dollars. Is there a premium or a discount to those two, one over the other, because one doesn't have the currency risk and the other does?
Paying a premium to hedge out the currency risk.
So you're paying more. So in other words, if those companies over there was an ETF and their spot price was 100, you'd be paying 101.5 here or something for that.
Yes.
Same thing.
Yes.
That's interesting. Yeah. Do you ever? Is there a trade there? If it gets too high or it gets too low, you want to buy one and short the other?
You could, yeah. I mean, absolutely. There, you know. But I think the thing is, you have to know the dynamic of you know, you have to understand the dynamic of currencies. And as I mentioned earlier, it's, to me, that's a huge challenge. And same thing with understanding the dynamic and the sovereign dynamic, if you will, because you really have to know the culture well. So for people that do international, I tend to rely on them more. You know, a close friend of mine was an international equity manager. You know, institutional and international equity manager. And if I have questions on China or France, I'll call him to see, like, how that's impacting us. In the bond world, in the corporate bond world, there's a euro market, euro bonds, and there are good opportunities there, but that's if you're buying a particular company. So first, my as an investor, I would go in and buy a company that's based in France because I like it, and I might buy the euro bond as opposed to buying, but the euro bond can still be dollar denominated. And you are right, you would pay a little bit of a premium. It's just a very small premium for that. But then it also allows you to have the exposure to, you know, you got to understand when the revenues come in from these companies, as they do with all the US companies, they're coming in different currencies. So it's all converted back to dollars. So there's, you know, you have to really like the company if you're going to invest over there, I think. I don't know about doing the currency play. I am not the person, you know, when it comes to trying to say the dollar versus, you know, the euro versus the yen, those calls to me are really difficult.
Well, one of these days, Dan, we should probably take 15 minutes and hopefully everybody won't. I mean, it can be, I'm not going to say that what we're going to talk about will be boring, but it can be a little tedious knowing ins and outs of currency markets and how they affect other stuff, but it's very important to at least have an idea.
Absolutely.
Of who's doing
what.
mean, I remember.
Absolutely. I think to have an understanding of the dynamics that go into currencies, what drives currencies, and then also the, you know, understanding the distinction. I mean, people who travel overseas get to see a little taste of it from the exchange rate, you know, so that's one little tiny taste of it. But I think understanding the flow of funds and the dynamics and the sovereign issues and the political issues and all that, I think that's.
I mean, those markets have been relatively quiet now for really the last year or two.
Absolutely, they've been very quiet, and you don't really hear much. You know, we're talking about like on the Bloombergs or the CNBCs or the Fox Business News. You don't hear much about foreign investment for U.S. investors.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is the central banks. This is it may be like this forever and ever now, but for the listeners, this is not a normal phenomenon that all these central banks talk to each other and act. I'll use the term in consist, right, you know, where they move together. I mean, this is not, because
right.
I remember my stepfather was executive at Waltham Watch and Hallmark Rings. And you might say, what does that have to do with anything? They would buy all their movements of the watches from Switzerland, and they would assemble them here right on Clinton. They had the factories over here. I can almost see it outside the window. But you don't need a factory to assemble watches. It's not like you need, I mean, people did it basically at a long row of desks in an office building. So it looks, you'd say that's your factory, and say it looks like an office. But anyway, that's where they were. So they would have to buy these, the inner workings of the watch from Switzerland, and they would have certain dates where they knew they would be delivered. So one night, of course, I pick him up, driving him home. And he goes, "Yeah, I was in grad school, so I mean, I've known some of this stuff." And I said, "Well, you know, what'd you do today?" He says, "Well, you know, it looks like the dollar's dropping," and all the news was how the dollar was dropping and these dirty speculators, you know, blah blah blah. That's all everybody's complaining about. So he said, "You know, we don't really have to buy these Swiss francs until July," and this is like April. He goes, "We bought them forward today because we didn't want the dollar to drop anymore with us getting caught." I said, "Oh, so you're one of the dirty speculators." And he goes, "Well, yeah, I guess I am."
You're one of them, right?
Well, but it's all just people saying the dollar don't look so hot. I need to buy Swiss francs. I'm gonna use today's price. It's no different than if you think the price of a car is going up, running up there and buying a car today.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. Although most people are not in tune with the concept, because you live in the U.S. and you never have to do this, of trading money for money. And money is just a good like anything else. But it's you don't, unless you, every time you walk 50 feet, you're changing the, for a Deutsch, well, last time when we were there, it was a Deutschmark, and then what were the Austrian guys? Were they the Kronas? I couldn't even remember half these things anymore. But then we went to Britain, and it was the pound. Every time you get off the plane, you're changing stuff, right? And you're very aware that, hey, wait a minute, how come this thing was worth 99 cents a week ago, and now it's worth 98? What the hell?
That to me, that was kind of confusing, because I did do a fair amount of travel for business around Europe, and then the Deutschmark, and then the Lira, and then peso, like from country to country. I wanted to bring up one point that is interesting, and we, you know, in terms of looking at investments on the bond side, certainly still like short term, you know, for the protection and the you know, the nice high yields, like the 5.5% that you're getting on a 5.40% that you're getting on a 3 month or a 6 month T-bill. I also like the current coupons going out 1 year. So you can get something with the 5% coupon trading at a discount and then giving you about 5.25%. We don't think we're going to see much on the rate cut side, but we do believe that they're going to, I believe, that short rates will continue to remain high. So that's still a decent investment. The yield curve being inverted is still kind of crazy. So there's been a lot of discussion about why the short rates are still higher than longer term rates and whether you should be going out 10 years or 30 years. My advice would be stay away from the 30 year. You're going to get ripped, you know, you're going to get whipsawed. If you happen to time it well on the 10 year, or if you had bought in earlier this week, you would have made some money because rates came down quite significantly with the news yesterday. But I would still say stay on the short end. Default rates are very low, so corporate bonds, you still pick up some return over treasuries. That's going to change at some point. There's going to be some financial issues with some of these companies, but right now we're in a very euphoric environment. So in the short term, corporates still look good. But what I believe still is a very good investment in municipal bonds. Municipals are still paying a healthy return, and then your after-tax return is a healthy yield, but your after-tax return is still very favorable. So there's low default rates in general with municipals. Even some places like Chicago, that I still think there's opportunity because we still have we're still in an environment where they're able to tax. The tax rates are increasing, as everybody knows. So there, I think it's a market that still looks attractive.
Yeah, when you say munis, I mean, we talked about this a couple of years ago when you first came on. I wouldn't touch a Chicago bond, but I mean, you could. There was one. Didn't you say you love the ones in like Tulsa and Grand Rapids and not Grand Rapids? What's the place in South Dakota? Grand something.
Oh yeah.
Some of these cities are amazingly well run, aren't they? Where they've got enough dough and pension funds and everything. And I mean,
even the state of Wisconsin, and you know, is fairly well. State of Virginia. I mean, there are certain states if you want to go for state bonds. Yeah, I mean, there's you know, an attractiveness. Again, we do our homework, so we look under the hood a little to see what else is going on. But there's the default rates in municipal bonds in general are very, very low. And like anything else, you want to be diversified, and that, you know, you want to have a portfolio. You don't want to just put it all in one place. Obviously, if you live in Illinois, you can find some bonds that are going to help you on the state tax side. It'll be the same in other high tax states like New York and California.
You got to be careful here. Dan, looking forward to seeing you when you come to town. It'll be in a couple of weeks. Yeah. SP Futures up 13, NASDAQ Futures up 132. Talk at you next week, bud.
Yep.
That's all, folks.